From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. Me, Martinez. You got mail-in voting questions? We've got the answers you can trust that'll get you through Election Day. Plus, before Kamala Harris, there was Charlotta Bass.
Her slogan was, win or lose, we win by raising the issues. And for her, it was about bringing civil rights issues into the public discourse.
Get to know the first black woman to run for VP. It's all ahead on Take Two. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app, this is Take Two. I'm Amy Martinez. Thanks for being with us on this Thursday. Coming up.
The good news is that your lenders for your mortgage are ready for your call.
Yeah, if you're one of the many people out there who's been laid off or furloughed, most money lenders are willing to work for you. They're waiting for your call. We've got advice on that and more all coming up. But we start today with a look at the Postal Service and what recent concerns about mail delivery mean for California. If news about delays and heated political rhetoric around voting by mail has you anxious about the November election, well, you're not alone. But there are important differences in how California runs elections that should ease some of your fears. KPCC senior politics reporter Libby Denkman is here to explain it all. Hello, Libby.
Hi, A.
All right. Now, California is mailing every voter a ballot this year because of COVID. So how big of a deal is that first?
It's really significant, but it's also an accelerated process of what's already been underway. The state's been moving to a primarily mail-in election for years now. In March, California's primary election, 72% of voters statewide used a mail-in ballot. And to be clear, the ballots are actually sent out by each county. 17 California counties have already adopted a system of sending every voter a ballot and operating fewer consolidated in-person vote centers open for 11 days. In fact, Los Angeles was the only one of these Voters' Choice Act counties that did not send a ballot to everyone for the March primary. Looking big picture, 8 states are sending ballots to all active voters for the November election. 5 of those have been conducting all-mail elections for years now. But California is the most populous state in the nation. And when it moved to expand voting by mail, that really drew the attention of critics like the president.
We're going to get to that in just a minute. By the way, Libby, remember back in March, that primary that you mentioned? 3 hours standing in line. Never again.
Yeah.
Never again. That is the last. And I like going and voting in person, but that's the last time I'm ever doing that. Now, for Los Angeles and many other counties, this is going to be new. So they're going to be dealing with a much higher volume of mail-in ballots. So what kind of preparations are local officials making to gear up?
Well, I talked to Neil Kelly, Registrar of Voters for Orange County. He said it's been about educating voters and leveling up the county's equipment to process a much larger volume of ballots.
When COVID really exploded, I just sat back in my chair and I thought, okay, what happens tomorrow if we have to have a 100% vote by mail election? So I ordered a second automated sorter for our ballots. And I doubled the number of scan stations and ordered those in March as well. All that equipment was just installed a few weeks ago. If today I had to do a 100% mail ballot election, we could do that.
So he sounds pretty confident,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That's Neil Kelly in Orange County. But it does take more time to process those mail-in ballots because each envelope has to be opened. The barcode has to get scanned, signature checked against the one in the voter file. Right now, most county registrars are also working to finalize their voting lists. Starting October 5th, that's 1 month before Election Day, they will start sending ballots to all active registered voters.
Ooh, you said active like this. Active. So what does active mean?
Good catch, A. Yes. So each county has a different criteria. There is no statewide standard or requirement to remove people from the voter rolls. In Orange County, Kelly tells me that they will count voters as inactive if they sat out the 2016 and 2018 federal elections. So they did not vote in those years. We have reached out to Los Angeles, Ventura, Riverside, San Bernardino, and Santa Barbara counties to get their criteria for what makes a voter inactive. And we'll report back as soon as we have that information. Now, inactive voters do not get sent election materials, but you can quickly get back on the active list by contacting your county elections office if you're worried about that. So the best thing to do right now is to go on the Secretary of State's website, make sure your voter registration information is updated, double check your address. If you want to register with a political party, you can do that. And you can also add an email address to your file. That helps registrars contact you with updates or important information about your ballot. And encourage your friends and family to check their status too. Why not? I mean, get started early this year, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, the president and conservative watchdog groups have attacked universal vote by mail. They say California will be sending out hundreds of thousands of ballots to people who are not eligible, and this will lead to fraud. So, Libby, any truth to that?
Here are the facts. Elections officials say they regularly clean up their voter files to remove inactive voters from their lists, like we just discussed. Often it's people who have died or they've moved, and they get death records from the Department of Public Health, change of address information from the DMV and unemployment offices. But some people do fall through the cracks. There are more than 20 million registered voters in California, and ballots do get sent to folks who have moved or are deceased. A man in Norwalk, for example, was charged last month with using his dead mother's ballots to vote in three elections. And this is a serious crime. If convicted, this man could go to prison for up to 3 years. But experts tell us voter fraud is extremely rare. The Washington Post analyzed all mail elections in Colorado, Washington, and Oregon and found under 400 cases of fraud reported out of 14.6 million ballots cast in 2016 and 2018. And despite the expansion of mail-in voting in recent years, there's zero evidence of systemic voter fraud in California. That would be the kind that could swing an election. It's also important to point out that President Trump has claimed mail-in voting helps Democrats at the polls, but that's just not supported by evidence. Stanford researchers have found the partisan effect of mail-in voting is actually neutral.
You're that KPCC viewers. Facts, facts, facts. All right, now, what about, well, you know what? There's a lot of information out there, Libby. You know that.
It's true.
We got to trust someone. We trust you. Now, okay, what about all the brouhaha over the Postal Service? Should we be worried that the mail delays we've been hearing about will mean ballots will not be counted?
Okay, so last month, the Postal Service sent letters to 46 states warning that mail-in ballots could arrive late to elections officials because of service delays. It set off a lot of alarm bells. Javier Becerra was among the state's attorneys general, lining up to sue over the problems. I know you guys talked to him this week. But in California, mail-in ballots are counted as long as they are postmarked on or before election day. And anticipating problems because of COVID-19, the state legislature already extended the deadline for ballots to arrive at county registrar offices to 17 days. So that really limits the potential danger in California to a smaller group of voters who may receive their ballots late if they register too close to November. Also, probably because of the public outrage and political pressure, the Postmaster General said this week he was halting the policy changes causing those delays. He said the USPS can handle any volume of election mail coming its way in November. Secretary of State Alex Padilla, though, says he doesn't entirely trust this administration, and so he's monitoring service disruptions that could hurt voting.
Okay, but how can folks make 100% sure they receive their ballots in the mail in time? And what do you do if you don't receive your ballot and the election is creeping up and getting closer?
I really can't say it enough. Double check your registration status now. Tell everyone in your circle to do the same. One clue is if you have received any mail so far this year from your registrar's office. In LA County, they've been sending out material to let voters know that they'll be getting a ballot in the mail this year, whether or not they signed up as a mail-in voter or not. And if after October 5th, you do not see that ballot showing up in the mail, contact your registrar's office. As a last minute, resort as kind of a safety net, in California, of course, you can register to vote same day up to and including election day. So you can go in if you have any issues, including election day at, you know, the last minute, and you can still cast a ballot. I want to point out, too, that mailing back your ballot isn't the only way to cast it. You can drop it off in a secure drop box at vote centers and various other locations around LA and Orange counties.
Now, once you've mailed your ballot in, Libby, or dropped it off in that drop box, as you said, how do you make sure that it is counted?
Yeah, mail-in ballots do get rejected, mostly because of signature mismatches. Younger voters and voters of color have been found to be more likely to have their ballots rejected. In California, you have a chance to cure your ballot if it's flagged for a signature mismatch. That means your county registrar has to contact you to alert you to the problem. And for peace of mind, there is this handy ballot tracker service online in most counties now. You can find it on the California Secretary of State's website, and we'll also link to it on LAS.com.
All right. Voting by mail isn't the only option in November. Some people will still want to cast their ballots in person, right? I'm not going to do it, Libby, but some people do.
I've heard. Yeah. You're done. Right. You can do it in person if you lost your ballot, if you need language help or disability accommodations, or you just feel better using the machine and knowing that it's been accepted right then and there. There will be in-person voting options. In fact, the LA County Registrar Recorder is actively soliciting ideas for large venues, including outdoor spaces, to use as vote centers in November. The Pomona Fairplex and Dodger Stadium have already been announced as polling places. In Orange County, they're using the Honda Center, and they will even allow drive-through voting there. In Voters' Choice Act counties like Orange and Los Angeles, it is that in-person voting is available for 11 days. That includes Election Day.
It's really election month in California, not Election Day. Libby, thanks a lot. That's KPCC senior political reporter Libby Dankman. Libby, thanks.
Thanks, A.
All right, staying with the mail, tomorrow, Postmaster General Louis DeJoy testifies before the U.S. Senate about the Postal Service slowdowns affecting the whole country. Then he goes before lawmakers in the House on Monday. But right here in Los Angeles, we're getting a picture of that slowdown and what's happening with postal equipment around the region. David Goldstein, investigative reporter for KCBS-TV, has that story. David, welcome.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, good.
All right, I'll go.
Now, you've got some stunning pictures of what this slowdown looks like on the ground in LA. So first, tell us what you saw outside of a post office near downtown.
Yeah, we did a couple of stories this week. One, we showed downtown, our chopper was overhead, and all these mailboxes that had been removed and are sitting in the back parking lot behind one of the main postal centers in near downtown LA. It looked like dozens of them laying on their side, sitting there, that sources say have been removed. Some of those have been removed over the last few weeks. And then outside the International Service Center near LAX, Postal Service Center, there were huge bags of mail coming in. These happen to be from China. What we saw with our eyes and videotape were three huge carts with mail piled up about 8 feet high. And earlier that morning, a source had sent me a picture, and there were five or six carts at that time. What they're saying is there's no room inside the facility because things have slowed down so much. So they end up leaving the mail out on the street until they have time to get it inside. And all this because of the cutbacks in overtime and the removal of equipment in all these facilities.
Sounds like Newman from Seinfeld is running the post office in LA, if you know the show Seinfeld. Now, what have you been able to uncover about the sorting machines that have been removed from SoCal area post office facilities? How many have been removed and from where?
Yeah, we found out statewide 92 sorting machines have been removed. Locally here, 16 in the Santa Ana Processing Center, two in the downtown LA one, and eight in a processing center in Santa Clarita. Now, these have been removed. We checked out the property. They're not on the back part of the property or anything. Sources saying they were carted away as junk. So even though the Postmaster General has now said he has postponing and stopping all these changes, there's no way for this equipment to get back inside or to put it back online. We also yesterday did a story where we had a photo that was leaked to us from a sorting machine in one of the LA facilities that is just shut down. It's sitting there, but again, they are not allowing it to go back online, even though the Postmaster General has said he is stopping what he has done. But as some of the union people said in the story, the damage is already done.
Wow. Now, you spoke to a local rep of the Post Office Workers Union. What did that person have to say?
You know, they're frustrated. They're trying to get the mail out. With these changes, before DeJoy stopped his changes the other day, what they were saying is they were told at some days to deliver first class mail and leave packages behind. Other days only deliver packages and leave first class mail behind. There was no rhyme or reason. They try to get the mail out, but they admit that things are 10 days to 2 weeks delayed. And we're hearing from viewers talking about medicine that one person just sent me on Twitter and sent me his tracking link, shows that the package was supposed to come from, I think, San Diego to his house in L.A. It was medicine. It ended up going to Arizona, then to Florida. Gosh. Now it's on its way back to California. And we have to assume that's because of some of these changes that went into effect. So people are really finding problems with this, and they are going to continue to have these problems.
David, that's life and death right there. I mean, that's nothing. I mean, it's funny, but it's not, because that's someone's medicine.
No, and as they've been talking about, is 80% of vets get their medicine through the U.S. Postal Service. I get my prescription through the Postal Service as well. So those things are going to be delayed continuously, because these machines, there's no way to get these machines back in place.
Now, you mentioned the medications. Paychecks also may be late arriving. Now we've got the holiday season coming up. Presents and holiday cards might be affected. From the people, David, that you have spoken to, what's their sense of what service will look like in the coming months?
You know, it's still going to be delayed. And you brought up the holidays. I mean, one of the union people I spoke to yesterday talked about with the Postmaster General saying he's going to delay any changes until after the election. But after the election comes the holiday season. So that's obviously their busiest time. So is the postmaster going to institute his changes again on November 4th? That would be, 6 weeks before Christmas? I mean, that's their busiest season. So they don't see things getting much better. I mean, they did ease up on some of the overtime restrictions in the last couple of days, I've been told. So they are working more to get the mail out. But again, when you remove all those mailboxes, when you remove the sorting machines, those are not going back on the streets or going back in the processing centers.
And David, you know, I know a letter carrier that works in Burbank, my area, and he told me he's begging people not to stop him, to ask him what's going on with the post office, because that delays him. But people want to know. And he says, I don't know. Don't ask me. So find out from David Goldstein, investigative reporter for KCBS TV. David, thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks, eh?
All right, with the pandemic, everyone's finances have either taken a hit or at the very least been affected in some way. Maybe your paycheck is smaller, or you're paying all your bills on your high-interest credit card. And considering that so many of your neighbors have many of the same problems, you don't want to add yours to theirs by asking them for advice. Well, that's why we're going to hear from a financial planner that's going to load you down with all the info that you need. She's coming up next when Take 2 continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm A. Martinez. By the way, there is a reason for all these sad farewell songs. We'll let you know coming up at the end of the show. More than 5 months into the pandemic, millions of Californians are still out of work and still relying on unemployment benefits to get by. But as time goes on, the state's unemployment system isn't getting any easier to navigate. Since March, you've sent us hundreds of questions about how to collect benefits. KPCC's David Wagner joins us to answer some of the more common questions that we've been getting lately. David, welcome back.
Great to be here.
All right. Now, there's been a lot happening with unemployment lately. Federal benefits expired last month. Not clear what, if anything, is going to replace them. And nearly a million Californians have still not received any benefits at all, even though they've applied and are probably eligible. So, David, I have to figure out that the people are probably confused about where things stand right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And, one of the questions we've been getting pretty often these days comes from freelancers who are asking if they still qualify for unemployment benefits. And the short answer here is yes, they do. But it's easy to see why they're confused. So, early on in this pandemic, Congress created this confusing patchwork of new unemployment programs, and they branded them all with really similar acronyms. So, one program was called PAC, or Pandemic Additional Compensation. And PAC gave people an extra $600 per week. That went to everyone receiving unemployment benefits. But as we know, that program expired in late July. Now there's this other program called PUA, or Pandemic Unemployment Assistance. And that one has not shut down yet. That's running through December 26th. And that is the program that provides benefits to freelancers and other types of workers who would normally not be eligible for benefits. So yes, freelancers are still eligible for benefits. They could be anywhere from $167 to $450 per week, depending on their past income. It's just that for now, they're not going to get that extra $600 per week tacked onto their claim.
Yeah, I can hear why it would be confusing to keep track of all these different programs. That's a real alphabet soup there. Now, speaking of freelancers, David, a lot of them have been sending you this question. Can I collect unemployment benefits while also using money from the Paycheck Protection Program? So what's the answer there?
Well, the answer is yes, in theory, but it is complicated, and I'd make sure that you really understand the rules of both programs before trying to do that. As we talked about earlier, unemployment benefits are available to freelancers, but many LA freelancers feel like they're getting shortchanged by the unemployment system. So instead, they're turning to small business loans through the Paycheck Protection Program because, as self-employed workers, they technically are small business owners. And they can use these loans to pay themselves. They can use them to pay for any business expenses they might have. But if you're collecting unemployment, you must report all your income to the state. And that includes income from these loans. And if that income is too large, it could wipe out your unemployment benefits. I did reach out to the state's unemployment office with this question, and they did say that if you're only partially compensating yourself through one of these loans, you could still qualify for reduced unemployment benefits.
We're taking your questions on unemployment, and we're answering them with David Wagner, KPCC reporter. Now, lately, a lot of people who got laid off early on in this pandemic have been slowly getting called back to work, and a lot of them have asked us this: if I go back to work part-time, will I lose my unemployment benefits? And David, that's a great question. What do you say to that one?
So that depends on things like how many hours are you going to be getting when you go back? How big is your paycheck going to be? You can get partial benefits if you're working less than you did before. But if you end up earning too much, your benefits can get wiped out entirely. And I talked with Legal Aid at Work attorney DeCarol Davis about this. She's been helping unemployment recipients across California with their claims. And Davis said there is one easy way to estimate whether going back to work is going to wipe out your benefits. You want to take your current weekly benefit award and multiply it by 1.33.
For example, you make $200 in your weekly benefit amount. You multiply that by 1.33. So that's going to equal approximately $267. So once you make more than that $267, your unemployment insurance is going to stop.
So put another way, let's say you make the maximum weekly benefit in California, which is $450. 450 times 1.33, that comes out to about $600. If you go back to work and earn more than $600 per week, you will lose your benefits, even if you're only working part-time.
Okay, now here is a very common question that's come up from listeners. How can I talk to a person at the state's unemployment office to get help with my claim? A person, a human being, David.
Yeah, this is a really common question that we've been getting. Some people have told me that they've been calling for months and still have never reached a person. Often the state's website is going to tell users to try calling an 800 number that's staffed 4 hours a day, 5 days a week. But your chances of reaching anyone there are pretty slim, according to Matthew Clark. He's an attorney with the Legal Aid Foundation of LA.
I have been advising hundreds of people for several months on trying to access unemployment benefits during the pandemic, and I have not heard from a single person who has ever gotten through to the ordinary EDD application line.
Clark told me instead you should try a different phone line that the department has staffed 7 days a week, 12 hours a day. That's an 833 number. We've got it posted on our website. Clark says most of his clients have been able to get through to someone on that line. It's going to take multiple attempts. Another warning, people answering that line are not always fully trained caseworkers, so they may not be able to fix your problem right away. You can ask them to place you on a callback list, putting you in line to get answers from someone who can, in theory, help you resolve your issue. The bad news there is that that callback list has a wait time of anywhere from 4 to 8 weeks.
Ugh, wonderful. That's KPCC reporter David Wagner answering some of your questions about California's unemployment system. David, thanks a lot for coming on.
No problem. I hope it was helpful.
And if you're still stumped by an unemployment problem we haven't talked about, just go to LAist.com, find David's story, and at the bottom of the story, you'll find a way to submit your own questions. All right, now some advice on how to stay afloat in this time of economic insecurity. According to the U.S. Labor Department, more than 213,000 California workers filed for first-time unemployment earlier this month. Meanwhile, those household bills just keep on pouring in. Elia Fernandez is a financial planner with Fernandez Financial Advisory in Los Alamitos. So we gave her a call to get some suggestions on how to cut expenses and weather the storm, starting with what people who were laid off recently can do to manage their budget.
Well, they really first need to know exactly what it costs them to live. And this is where I would divide those expenses between the essential expenses and the nice to have discretionary expenses. Because if we're going to lose some kind of supplement for the week, every week, we need to really know what our bare bones budget is. The good news is you can sit down and figure that out or use a program like Mint that's available online and that's free. But think housing, food, transportation, healthcare. Certainly think about your phone and your internet. And know that there is help out there for you if you can't meet some of those expenses.
Delia, when it comes to someone's budget, what would you say are some of the bigger expenses that you would suggest to people to remove?
Well, gosh, it depends on lifestyle. We make a big commitment when we make a commitment to housing, and it's probably the hardest thing to change unless you're renting. If you're renting, then the lease runs out, or if you're month to month, you can make a change. If you own a house, then you've made a commitment. Made a commitment to probably a mortgage, to utilities, to maybe a homeowners association, insurance, certainly property taxes. That is a very large expense. So it's one of those expenses that takes a lot longer to change. Probably the things that are easier to change are what we call discretionary expenses. We all need to eat, but we don't have to go out to a restaurant all the time.
That's a good one because, well, number one, there aren't many restaurants to go out and get food from anymore. You could do takeout, but I guess you're right. If you can eliminate that and maybe, I don't know, fix your meals at home, do a little bit more shopping in the store and bring stuff back that you can arrange for yourself more cheaply, that could be a big money saver that people maybe aren't that aware of.
Well, it could be huge, particularly if we enjoy a glass of wine or another drink with our meal. And I admit, it's one of the pleasures of life.
So what advice do you have for families managing a mortgage, car payment, and kids? These are things that obviously we're not going to stop paying, and we got to plan for in the future. So how do you do that?
We need to reach out to the lenders that we have to see how we can get some relief. The good news is that your lenders for your mortgage are ready for your call. There are programs out there that might actually help you delay your payments or even add what you owe to the end of your mortgage, but you need to call your lender right away. That's going to be extremely important. You also need to call your home insurance company and see if they're going to be able to offer any relief. And we didn't talk about it, but you know, maybe there's some relief for you to your utilities as well. But really, that mortgage is going to be the big one, isn't it?
Yeah, and I guess you mentioned how they are waiting for your call. I think a lot of people get intimidated and think, well, there's no way they're going to help me with my mortgage. I mean, I got to pay them. Why would they help me? But they are. They're willing to help, especially right now.
they're willing to help because Congress got together in March and said, oh my gosh, this is a huge crisis and we need everybody mobilized. So the mortgage lenders are ready and waiting for your call. Now you're going to have to do some things in writing to request some relief or forbearance, which is when the amount that you owe is added to the end of your mortgage. But there are programs out there waiting for you. It just depends on what type of mortgage you have and what your lender is willing to do for you.
We're talking to Delia Fernandez with Fernandez Financial Advisory in Los Alamitos. Now, for those who have lost their jobs but want to try and keep their health insurance, what would you suggest they look into as far as what Covered California and the ACA has to offer?
Well, they need to go out to the Covered California website and figure out where they fit in the types of coverage that they could have available to them. And they also need to know that there's a wonderful website, 211LA.org. that has a number of resources available, including resources to help you with health insurance. Health insurance, counseling, reemployment opportunities, training, food. It's just a wonderful resource, and there's a fellow version of it or a parallel version of it in Orange County, 211OC.org.
You know, we were talking about lenders earlier, mortgages, and when it comes to car payments. When it comes to credit cards, Delia, how different is that? Let's just say you have a card with a very high interest rate. Are those lenders as eager to take your call and listen to you as the ones we talked about earlier?
Well, it's kind of hard to say. They sure might not be. You could go to the National Association of DebtAdvice.org, the National Association of Credit Counselors. It is a nonprofit, and you could talk to them if you have debt that you can't pay. Be very careful not to run up your credit cards and think that you're going to live off of your credit cards. It would actually be better if you give them the minimum or call them and see if you can work out a deal. Because the first things first, you've got to have a place to live, you've got to have health care, and you've got to be able to pay for your food and transportation. So don't agonize over some of the credit card debt that's unsecured debt.
Any last piece of advice for folks navigating these difficult times? I know you're a big advocate for keeping track of your credit score constantly. I do it all the time, Delia, because you told me to do so. And I obsess over it now. I watch that number like a hawk.
Well, the good news is that the government, when Congress got together to talk about COVID relief, they said that we could check our credit reports now at no cost once a week. Used to be it was once a year. Now, I don't know why I would check my credit report from all three bureaus once a week, but I do strongly recommend it because we all need to get smarter about our credit.
Delia Fernandez is a financial planner with Fernandez Financial Advisory in Los Alamitos. Delia, as always, thank you very much for your advice.
Oh, no problem. Thanks for having me.
All right, California Senator Kamala Harris made history this week when she accepted the VP nomination. But before Kamala Harris, there was Charlotta Bass. Get to know the first black woman to run for VP. That's coming up next when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC, I'm A. Martinez. Last night, Kamala Harris officially accepted the vice presidential nomination at the Democratic National Convention. Before doing so, she reflected on her mother.
I keep thinking about that 25-year-old Indian woman, all of 5 feet tall, who gave birth to me at Kaiser Hospital in Oakland, California. On that day, she probably could have never imagined that I would be standing before you now and speaking these words. I accept your nomination for Vice President of the United States of America.
Harris's nomination to the vice presidency is history-making, but she's not the first black woman to receive the nomination. In 1952, Charlotta Bass, an African-American woman, was nominated for the vice presidency. On top of that, she also ran a newspaper, fought for civil rights, and stared down the Klan. For this week's Throwback Thursday, we're revisiting the story of Charlotta Bass.
California, land of romance.
There is probably no single area holding so much of charm and beauty and the good things of life as Southern California.
Once a sleepy ranch town, now home to the stars of Tinseltown, the captains of industry and over 1 million men, women, and children.
There are boys and girls from the large cities and small towns. Each brings his dreams, his hopes, and his ambitions.
Robert Peterson is the host of the Hidden History of Los Angeles podcast. He's here to tell us about her story. Robert, welcome to Take Two.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. Pleasure to be here.
All right. When you list off her accomplishments, I mean, Charlotta Bass truly sounds like a superhero. I mean, she might as well have been wearing a cape back then. That's how amazing she sounds. But let's start with her career as a newspaper publisher. Tell me about the California Eagle.
Sure. The California Eagle is actually the oldest black newspaper in Los Angeles. And Charlotta Bass, she came to L.A. when she was about 30 years old in 1910, and she started working for the Eagle. At that time, it was called the Eagle. And the owner of the paper eventually got ill and died, and Charlotta Bass took over the paper, and she put out her first issue in 1912. And she used the paper, the California Eagle, as a platform to advocate for a variety of civil rights issues, to fight against housing discrimination, employment discrimination. Even things like stereotypes and media stereotypes and portrayals
really?
Of people of color
back
in
then.
Movies. Even
wow.
back then.
That's amazing. A newspaper that pretty much wrote for people of color in SoCal back in the teens. I mean, that's way ahead of its time. Then there's, over the years, the Japanese newspaper, Rafu Shimpo, L.A. Sentinel came along in the 30s. What was the public perception of the California Eagle back then?
Well, so the California Eagle actually had a pretty good circulation in the tens of thousands. I would say that Charlotta Bassman was a voice of the black community, but she also spoke on behalf of other communities of color. Mm-hmm. For example, like the Sleepy Lagoon murder trial, she joined the Defense Fund and spoke out against the injustice of trying, however it was, a dozen, 14 people in a kangaroo court and trying them for murder without due process. So she did speak about issues that were also beyond the black community as well.
We're talking to Robert Peterson, host of the Hidden History of Los Angeles podcast. We're speaking about Charlotta Bass, an incredible figure in L.A. history. Now, her time running the Eagle segued really into her work as an activist. What kind of things did Bass advocate for?
Well, that was something that was really special and unique about Charlotta Bass is because she wasn't just a journalist. Her activity went beyond the pages of the California Eagle. And I'll give you an example. In 1914, a black woman named Mary Johnson bought a house on East 18th Street near Central Avenue, near where the 10 freeway is mm-hmm. today. And at the time, the neighborhood was all white, and neighbors were very unhappy about a black person moving in. So what did the neighbors do? Well, when Mary Johnson was out on errands one day, some neighbors broke into her house, took all the belongings out of the house, including all the furniture, put it on the lawn, and then put a sign in her yard which read, "N-word, if you value your hide, don't let night catch you here."
Wow. Hmm.
So Mary Johnson actually went to Charlotta Bass for help. And what Bass did is she contacted a local women's group and basically arranged for a brigade of 100 women to march down to the house to plant themselves out at the house. Then they called the police and demanded that some sheriff's deputies come. Eventually, two deputies did come. They took down the sign and actually helped Ms. Johnson put her furniture back in the house. But I think that's something that, you know, just in the face of this hatred and potential violence, you know, there's 100 women there. Yeah. You're not gonna intimidate us to get out and move out of this neighborhood.
It's an OG women's march, right?
Yes,
way
exactly.
back in the day. Yeah. Now, her accomplishments do not end there because the thing that's almost the capper for her story is that she went on to get nominated as a vice presidential candidate for the Progressive Party. How did that happen?
Well, Charlotta Bass eventually was involved in Republican politics, but she got disillusioned with both political parties. She didn't think that they really you know, spoke to the civil rights issues. So she got involved with the Progressive Party, and she was picked as the vice presidential candidate in the 1952 election. She knew they were going to lose. They only got a few hundred thousand votes, but I think her slogan was interesting. Her slogan was, win or lose, we win by raising the issues. And for her, it was about bringing civil rights issues into the public discourse.
She seems like such an impressive leader. I mean, not just for L.A. and California, but just in general. What would you say, Robert, is her biggest imprint on this city's history?
That's a good question, because I think it's a pretty wide-ranging imprint. But I think in terms of bringing the issues of – she had her hands in a lot of different pots in housing discrimination and employment discrimination. She helped desegregate L.A. County General Hospital. I mean – we have black nurses and you know, a multiracial staff, partly because of her efforts. But I think it's really about bringing the civil rights movement in L.A. along and making it much more successful. Talking, this is very early days in the teens, the 20s, the 30s. She kind of helped develop the civil rights movement in Los Angeles. And I think that will probably be her most lasting legacy.
You know, every once in a while we hear stories of people and then we think, well, why haven't I heard of this person before? So, Robert, why haven't we heard of Charlotta Bass before?
That is a great question. And it's one that I hate to say it, I probably will not have the most satisfying answer for, you know, because I think about, you know, you list off her accomplishments. You know, she ran for city council. She ran for state senate. She ran for vice president. You know, she was sued by the Klan. She was surveilled by the FBI. All these types of things that are really interesting.
Yeah.
But so I think number one, generally, we have a troubled relationship with history in the city. We don't do the best at remembering and preserving our history. I think that's amplified when we're talking about persons of color. You know, there is an argument out there that sometimes when we talk about black history in LA, that there's a lot of emphasis on the Watts riots and the LA riots. And sometimes some of the earlier history is overshadowed a little bit. And there may be some truth to that. But it's just, it still boggles my mind. There's no published biography about Charlotta Bass. I mean, this would be make a great movie. There's a scene that I think about where the Klan sued her and started calling the California Eagle and threatening her. And then some Klan members showed up at the California Eagle office while Charlotta Bass was there at night alone. And Charlotta Bass sitting alone at night in the California Eagle office, some Klan members outside demanding to be let in. What does Charlotta Bass do? She doesn't run. She doesn't hide. She doesn't call the police. She goes, grabs a gun, and goes to the window and lets the Klan members know that she's not going to be intimidated. And actually, the Klan members, when they saw the gun, they retreated into the night. And a story like that, it does boggle my mind that it does not become more well-known.
You saying it, I already pictured it on a movie screen. I pictured actors, actresses already playing all those roles. So there you go. Hollywood screenwriters, there you go. A story that's made for the screen. Robert Peterson is the host of the Hidden History of Los Angeles podcast. He spoke with us today about Charlotta Bass, an incredible figure in LA's history. Robert, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much.
Did you know the state of California has a public awareness campaign to really motivate people to wear a mask? Want to know the snappy, inspired, creative name of this campaign? It's Wear a Mask. That's it. That's the name of the campaign. We'll find out how well it's working when Take Two continues.
You just call out my name.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and on the KPCC app. I'm A. Martinez. All right. You know, if you find yourself in an area with lots of people these days, you are supposed to be wearing a mask. It's a state order in order to slow the spread of the coronavirus. The thing is, we all know a lot of people are not wearing them out there in Southern California. and the Los Angeles Times. I'm a little upset about that, but that's just me. LA Times ran a little research experiment to back all that up. Data scientist Casey Miller and a few of her colleagues hung out in some highly trafficked areas in LA and in Orange County and actually counted who was wearing a mask and who wasn't, and who was just wearing them incorrectly. Casey's here now. Welcome, Casey.
Hello.
All right, I'm a little obsessed on the subject of masks, but what prompted you guys to go out and do this research?
So I actually have been kind of like doing this on my own when I'm walking around my neighborhood.
You and me both, Casey. I've been doing this for a while too.
I'm very passionate about people wearing masks, and it drives me up the wall when I go out and, you know, less than half people I see are wearing them. So it was mostly kind of a question of, I don't think this is just my neighborhood, and how many people are actually wearing masks?
All right, so where did you wind up going, and what was the methodology?
So we went to three different places. We went to the Abbot Kinney area of Venice, Main Street and Huntington Beach, and a park in North Long Beach.
We chose
those because they were all pretty well trafficked and all kind of diverse in terms of, you know, either being beachy, but also having a bunch of stores nearby and being pretty decent thoroughfares for folks, and also places where there is an outside space people would be walking around.
All right. Now, you guys have some pretty cool illustrations and graphics to go with the piece in the LA Times. But since this is radio, okay, how did you guys define those who wore masks incorrectly?
So we did it as like basic as we could. Basically, it was if you were not wearing a face covering that covered your nose and your mouth, it was incorrect.
Yep.
The only exception to that being, you know, people who didn't have one on at all, kind of as not wearing a mask.
Yeah. Now, okay, we should say this research is limited in scope, but it seems the people walking around in Venice were the best rule followers when it came to masks. So what did you find in Venice?
Yeah, so that's definitely true. We found that 58% of the people that we observed in Venice were wearing masks correctly, which is definitely more than either other places we checked. It would also had the most people who were wearing them sort of correctly.
So 58% in Venice, LA County, the city of Los Angeles. Okay, that doesn't surprise me too much. The worst, though, which I am sorry to say will probably surprise no one if they are following this mask saga, is Huntington Beach. So what did you find in Huntington Beach?
Yeah, absolutely. In Huntington Beach, we found that only 28% of people were wearing masks correctly.
I'm shocked that that number's that high. Okay, I mean,
yeah, it definitely didn't feel like it some of the times when we were sitting there watching people. It almost felt like there was no one, but it did turn out to be 28%.
Did you ever see that video by the two comedians, Chad and JT, that were trying to hand out masks in Huntington Beach? I spoke to them. And they nearly got beat up a few times. I mean, it was that intense when they offered a mask for free in Huntington Beach, and people were very aggressive toward them in insisting that they didn't want one, they didn't need one. Why are you here?
Yeah, I will say that we did not actually go out and like speak to folks. We passively observed, mostly to remain safe. And I wanted to send people out. They volunteered to help me with this experiment, and I wanted to keep everybody safe, but I can believe it.
Good call, Casey. Very good call. Now, Long Beach. Long Beach was kind of in the middle, right?
Yes. Long Beach was in the middle. It was a little bit slower in terms of the number of people we counted. It wasn't quite as busy, but about 40% of people were wearing masks correctly.
Did anyone approach you, Casey, to find out what you're doing? I mean, you're kind of like are counting people, maybe even pointing at them to kind of get a good count. I don't know how you did it, Casey, but did anyone approach you and say, what are you doing?
Yeah, no, I definitely got a few weird looks when I was in Huntington Beach. No one came over to me. Pretty much everybody did this from their cars, which was warm, but not as hot as it would be, you know, this week. It wasn't quite as hot the week we did this. I definitely would say, yeah, some people noticed, but it wasn't too bad.
Now, taking the observations from all of these different places together, major takeaways, Casey?
Major takeaways would be largely people aren't wearing masks correctly, and that of those who are, women are more likely to wear masks than men.
Wow, women. Well, I guess that's not surprising. Men are stupid. I'm one of them. I know. So it's true. I'm not going to cover for guys. We're idiots. Now, what do you hope other people might take away from this study of yours?
You know, it's one of the things I found most frustrating is that I read a bunch of, you know, surveys from people when we were starting to do this. And a lot of times people are questioned as to whether or not they wear masks. The results are like really high. It's like, you know, do you always wear a mask or almost always wear a mask? And the answers are definitely above 50%, sometimes as high as 90. And people aren't doing that. When you ask more granular questions, you know, the real results start to come out, or actually observe people. But people really seem to say that they do things that they actually aren't following through on. And we all know that it's very important to wear a mask right now. This is the way that we're going to help stop spread the virus. Yeah. And just saying you do it isn't really going to help anything.
So, and if people want to check out the article, there's a little space that allows people to conduct their own mask count. Casey, how does that work?
Yeah, there's a space near the bottom of the article where if you're, you know, out walking around or sitting on your patio or whatnot, you can, there's some three buttons. It's pretty simple. You can track people walking by and click whether they're wearing a mask correctly, wearing it incorrectly, or not wearing one at all. And you'll get a little bar chart next to it or below it that shows up and gives you your results in real time.
You know, Casey, before the pandemic, and I'm not kidding about this, I've always wanted to wear a mask in public because you just never know who you're going to run into. You don't want to, you know, round a corner and just get into someone's sneeze, right? That's horrible and disgusting to even think about. But one of the things about this now for forever, I'm going to wear a mask in public. If I have to go anywhere indoors, this pandemic at least has given me the ability not to feel self-conscious about wearing a mask, because that's it. It's going to be me in a mask really till the end of time. Casey Miller is a data scientist, Drew, with the LA Times, and recently filed a report that shows how few people are wearing masks in crowded areas in our area. Casey, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, now to a moment that I have both been dreading and looking forward to. Dreading because it's the last day for Take Two producer Lori Skywalker Galloretta. Anytime a workplace loses a bright, positive light like Lori G is to us here at KPCC, it really makes that place a little bit darker. But we're not necessarily sad about her leaving, which brings me to why I've been looking forward to today. Anytime a friend is taking on a new job, one that excites them because it'll challenge them, you can't be sad. You just can't be sad. You can only be happy for them, even if it means that they're not going to be around anymore. So good luck, LG. Take Two, we'll miss you. Lori and I have done a lot of field interviews all around Southern California. My favorite memory is going to be at the Autry Museum. It was a food tasting, like cuisine of the Old West. And so Lori is to my right. She's set up the mic. She's, you know, monitoring the interview. I'm eating food and talking and eating food and talking. And I'm eating so much food that the chair that I was sitting on split right down the middle and I fell like this to the floor. And I looked up as I am on the ground tasting the floor. And I'm looking up at Lori Galloretta, and she almost falls off her chair, too, out of total laughter. More Take Two tomorrow at 2. Talk to you guys then.